The case will be taken under advisement. We move to the second case this morning, Pontrager v. Indiana Family and Social Services.
May it please the court.
Wait a minute, we've got a crowd leaving the courtroom.
All right.
Don't take it personally, Mr. Steiner.
I won't. Gives me time to get a little bit more ready.
I think it's more than money. Okay, Mr. Steiner.
Good morning. Our first point is that there was no private right of action in this case, so there shouldn't have been an injunction. As this court indicated in the Bertram case, there is no provision in Medicaid law that explicitly creates a private right of action.
But Mr. Steiner, we also said that we are the Court of Appeals. We're not the Supreme Court. And Gonzaga didn't overrule Wilder. Hmm. The Supreme Court itself may choose to do that someday, but it has been very clear. Think of cases like State Oil against Kahn, reminding the courts of appeals that we're not supposed to get in front of them on that kind of question. So I'm not sure what you think we can do.
Well, we believe it should be considered an open question. Perhaps it is something that the Supreme Court will take up.
Are you making a categorical argument about 1396AA? I know your office was here a few months ago on the Planned Parenthood case and essentially made that argument about A23, the same argument you're making here. Is this your position on everything under 1396AA?
Not really. We're really just focusing in on this optional dental benefit and the cap that the state of Indiana has. We haven't tried to analyze it in any other way or make any presumption, any statements in this case that are, you know, broad-ranging regarding 1396A10.
But how could there be no private right of action for optional dental care under 1396A10 and a private right of action for other things? Surely you're making a legal argument.
We are making a legal argument, and
which we have rejected in Bertrand as beyond our authority to do.
Well,
I mean, what you're saying is we should sit there and read the Supreme Court decisions, infer from Gonzaga that Wilder is now no longer good law, and make that statement ourselves. And if we were three law professors, I'm sure we'd be quite free to do that in an article. But the Supreme Court has told us not to do that.
Well, it's also a situation where, in order to even have an opportunity to place this kind of issue in front of the Supreme Court, we need to bring it here.
You are welcome to bring it here for preserving for later Supreme Court review, and we certainly respect that as a reasonable litigation approach.
But and I do think that you should consider it. I mean, I realize that you may feel constrained in some ways by, you know, prior case law. However, in order to be able to fully understand these issues as they move up through the courts, it's useful if the court will make a good analysis.
Well, that's true, too.
And you might say that you believe, even if you feel constrained, that you believe that under Gonzaga and Blessing that there is no private right of action, and that could have some influence.
I mean, that's an advisory opinion, and it's actually one that flies in the face of what every other court of appeals has said. By my count, the 9th, 3rd, the 5th, the 6th, and the 8th circuits have all disagreed with your position.
Well, then, if this court indicated that the opposite approach should occur, that might be a case that could go to the Supreme Court.
They wouldn't take a dicta statement. But anyway, I mean, you know, if for preserving your argument, you're doing just fine, so we can...
Well, I hope you'll, you know, give this strong consideration. As the district court indicated, if he felt that he wasn't constrained, actually by a decision decided before Gonzaga, you know, et cetera, Blessing, the Miller case, he said he would have ruled that there was no private right of action. At least he intimated that that's where he would come from. We do believe that this is a case where, if you really analyze it under Gonzaga and Blessing, you will find that 1396A, 810 has provisions that are very vague and amorphous.
They don't seem that vague to me, to tell you the truth, because even going through the Blessing test, the statute talks about medical assistance being available to individuals. That sounds like it's rights creating, and the Fifth Circuit has so found. I don't really think there's any particular vagueness that says make medical assistance available to it. You can specify in your plan the amount, duration, and scope of services. You've got each service has to be sufficient to achieve its purpose, et cetera, et cetera. What's vague about that?
Well, one of the provisions says amount, duration, and scope of medical assistance made available to individuals in the group. There is case law out there, and in fact, provisions in the statute itself that suggest that we should focus more on whether we're providing adequately and sufficiently for the group of people who might receive this benefit, as opposed to whether each individual is getting exactly the care that they would desire.
Right. You make that argument. I find that inconsistent with the statutory language focusing on individuals, to be honest.
Well, they're both in the... there's both provisions in that very section that talk about these things. One that does suggest very strongly that we're focusing on a larger group of people than just the individual.
What statutory language are you relying on that undermines the language in 1396AA10 referring to individuals?
Well, it refers to individuals. However, we also have this language about the plan needing to be essentially indicating that there can be some limitations when we talk about amount, duration, scope.
Well, it says each service, that's the regulation, each service must be sufficient in amount, duration, and scope to reasonably achieve its purpose.
The statute does say this, use the same language in several places, amount, duration, and scope. It doesn't use other limiting language. That's in the regulation, the other limiting language. But the amount, duration, and scope is in the statute itself. So I do think it is there, and that should be considered as broadening this and making it difficult to know exactly what right the individuals would have here to particular care.
Surely, if it's completely up to the state to decide whether it wants dental care in the plan. So if the state of Indiana decides it doesn't want dental care in the plan, dental care won't be in the plan. But if it is in the plan, then you've got to give people dental care. You can't say, sorry, you need a root canal, but we're not going to give it to you. Or sorry, you need some gum work or whatever people have done with their teeth. Many dental services are very expensive. And people can be in tremendous pain if they need dental services.
It's also a situation, though, where part of the plan itself is this cap.
Well, that's the question before us. It's not... The question is, if you have a cap, have you, in fact, satisfied the requirement that the service has to be sufficient in amount, duration, and scope to reasonably achieve the purpose?
That's right.
I don't see how a cap is necessarily consistent with that. Suppose you had a cap on orthopedic services, and so you get to go to the you break your leg and you get to go to the doctor once, but you don't have any money for the follow-up, so the cast just has to stay in your leg forever. I mean, surely that would be absurd.
Well, you could. You really do need to look at each thing individually. We're talking about
here. You're talking about a structure, or actually in your brief, I think you actually admit that maybe somebody can buy the bottom dentures, but not the top ones. I mean,
I'm not sure we said that in. Sure we actually said that in our brief. We may have said that at some point. I don't know. I don't recall for certain. But
you would agree that that would really not sound like it was reasonably achieving the purpose.
Well, the purpose, when you look at the merits, the purpose can be looked at either individually or as a group. We say...
Well, no, that's a question. I don't mind you phrasing that as a question, but I think that's actually an issue here.
It may be. We contend that just like the decisions from the Fourth and Fifth Circuits that we've cited that have focused more on providing, you know, sufficient, adequate care for the group, that's what we're doing here. In fact, we may be doing better for the group than we did before when we had a $600 cap and some exceptions that occurred. Now we have a $1,000 cap that may well provide more benefit to more people.
And but I can understand a group focus if you wanted to say, for instance, in your plan, you didn't want to cover liver transplants because they're very expensive, mm-hmm. but you are going to cover, you know, cancer treatments, even though they're expensive, so something like that. Because you might think that more people are going to need cancer treatments, and you can save a lot of money at the top end with no liver transplants. But I thought that was really what the statute was talking about at group levels.
Well, I think it goes beyond that. It's the language itself, I think, can accept, just the language itself can accept a cap, because that goes to amount or scope when we use those terms.
But is it a sufficient amount for the individual?
Well, or is it a sufficient amount for the group? It depends on how you're going to focus on this.
What if somebody, I'll give you an example. This actually happened to one of my daughters, not the most coordinated person, you know, who fell flat on her face in the garage one day and knocked all of her teeth. Luckily, she had braces, so they didn't all fall out. But it required quite a bit of dental care, root canals, all sorts of things. And suppose she had fallen again later in the same year. Would I have been required just to say, well, too bad, you know, this time you're not going to save your teeth?
Well, I don't know what the situation
seems,
would really be.
Seems to me like yes, because I can assure you it was more than $1,000 the first time.
Now, there is a situation where if this really goes to the, you know, threatening to the life, that kind of thing, of the individual.
It wasn't threatening to her life. It was threatening to her teeth.
Well, the real question is then that going to be a situation where, well, in Indiana, of course, she would be able to get the $1,000.
Right, and I'm saying, suppose which was true, we exhaust that the first time she stumbles and falls down. Then she stumbles and falls down in the middle of a soccer game later. And then you just have to say, oh, well, sorry, kid, no more teeth in the front.
Well, there would be a situation where this would be a situation where Indiana wouldn't pay more than $1,000.
Right.
I'll admit
and
that.
And we have indigent people, affidavits in the record, they simply don't have the money. So it's, sorry, kid, you're not going to have
teeth.
Well, I
think it was an affidavit from one person,
the plaintiff.
Yeah.
So that was nothing wrong with that.
Although in her, it's an interesting situation. In her case, she was actually involved in a Medicaid spend down. So while she said in her affidavit that she had no money at all to pay for anything above $1,000, she's involved in a Medicaid spend down, which would suggest that maybe she had some money.
But that's an assumption on the state's part. It's kind of a strange part of your brief, because both Indiana law and federal law establish income eligibility criteria for Medicaid participation, and I don't think we should decide this case on the basis of people evading those requirements.
Well, I'd like to really point out that, you know, that we ought to really follow, I think, the kind of approach they took in the Curtis and the Charleston hospital case. They recognized that you would be better served, I think, if your plan meets the needs of the vast majority of people, as opposed to whether it meets every individual need of the of the individual. Remember, we are dealing with a certain kind of dental care here that is limited. It's for adults. The children, there's no limitation for the children, but for persons 21 years and older, there is this $1,000 limit, but it's only for these more routine kind of
Well, that's all $1,000 will cover. It will cover two cleanings and maybe one set of x-rays a year. It won't cover fillings. It won't cover root canals. It won't cover crowns. It won't cover pretty much anything else.
Well, it doesn't. It may not cover everything. So it's similar, what Indiana's done, it's similar to the kind of plan that insurance plan that the state has for its own employees, which is to cover about $1,000 worth of care, and then anything beyond that.
I hope.
Well, I'm not claiming to be. No.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear it.
But nevertheless, it can be very difficult for people to cover those costs as well. And I think, when you're talking about trying to have a reasonable plan, one that is similar to what an insurance company covers, is not necessarily unreasonable. There's reasons for these kind of caps, and that is so that you can meet the needs of most people, yet at the same time attempt to be able to provide this dental benefit in the state of Indiana, because there would be concern if it becomes too costly that you would eliminate it. Now, that is not necessarily something that is good for the vast majority of people who are receiving
Medicaid. It's a political issue in
Indiana
about which we have no say.
But I do think it goes to reasonableness and adequacy. I see my light has come on. I think that means that I'm into my rebuttal time, and I'll reserve that and come back.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. It's undisputed that the dental services that Sandra Bontrager requested are both medically necessary and covered. The only reason that she didn't get those services is because of this $1,000 cap.
So are you worried at all about a Pyrrhic victory in this case? I mean, if you were to prevail on the focus on the individual and the need to provide medically necessary services, why won't the state just turn around tomorrow in today's climate and say, well, the heck with it, we're just not going to cover dental at all?
Well, Your Honor, first, as you pointed out earlier, it's irrelevant to whether or not the state is allowed to violate state and federal law.
True. No, I guess I'm just asking a broader question, because it seems to me it's unclear what the fallout, if were you to prevail on your legal reading of the present state, what's going to happen tomorrow?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's worth noting that the state currently has a surplus of billions of dollars. This is common knowledge. It's on the state auditor's website. It's on the state budget agency's website. The current surplus is $1.8 billion. It's hard to believe that the state would decide to get rid of dental coverage that it has maintained for decades just so that it can save less than a quarter of 1% of its current budget surplus.
But there are a lot of organizations can make that argument, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But and as I said, I mean, ultimately it comes down to the fact that that's up to the legislature. I would have a hard time believing that would actually happen, but of course it's a possibility.
So let's focus on this question about whether we ought to be thinking about the individual and that individual's access to services versus what your opponents say is, oh, well, this is fine for whatever number they're saying, 90, 95% of the people in Indiana, and for the people who need more, tough luck, they just won't get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, Your Honor, what I would point out is what you were discussing earlier, which is the actual language of the federal Medicaid law. It says that medically necessary services have to be made available to all individuals and families, not to most individuals and families. That statutes actually use the word all, and there's no reason to believe that all doesn't mean all. But second, I would also point out, Your Honor, that the state's not, it is not clear that the state is providing for most medically necessary services. Under this cap, under this $1,000 cap, certain dental services will never be paid for by the state because they cost over $1,000. And the state knows this. The state sets the reimbursement rates, and it has set some of them at over $1,000. So basically for those services, the state is saying we will never pay for it, even if it's medically necessary. And also under this limit, certain services that must be provided together, like a full set of dentures, will never be provided by the state, ever, because it's over $1,000. And that was the situation with Sandra Bontrager, the plaintiff herself. She needed dental services that were over $1,000. And
she was having implants, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. She needed abutments and implants. And together, the services cost well over $7,000. So to say that she, a person on Medicaid, should be able to cover the costs not covered by the state would be obviously wrong. And of course, a recipient will also be completely denied any medically necessary service that she needs at a point in the year after she's already reached her $1,000 limit.
We get into a situation where it's determined whether there are alternative methods of providing the same, not cosmetic, but serviceable use of other teeth that you can use.
Right, Your Honor. The one of the main points about this $1,000 cap is it has absolutely nothing to do with medical necessity. So we haven't looked at what's necessary or what could be more helpful or, you know, what other service might be better. This has nothing to do with any of that. It's just a hard monetary cap that kicks in. And the state's figures about who it claims is going to be covered, even under this cap, doesn't take into consideration the fact that these are Medicaid recipients who, by definition, are poor. And so if they need a service that's over $1,000 or services that together are over $1,000, they will do what the plaintiff did, Sandra Bontrager. They will simply go without the service because they can't afford to pay the costs that aren't covered by the state. And these people are not included in the state's figures about who will need more than $1,000. It's hard to understand how the state can claim on the one hand that this cap is only going to affect very few recipients, and on the other hand, it's going to save them millions of dollars. Unless the state's estimates do take into consideration all the many recipients who will simply go without the services at all.
Well, when one isn't covered, it adds up very quickly.
Exactly.
The amounts for each individual who would bust the cap would be very large.
Well,
so even a small number.
If it were a very small number of people who are affected, and we go with the state's numbers about how much it will save, those people would, yes, they would need about like 280% of the $1,000 cap. Those people would need really expensive dental services. But
so that leads me to my question. You mentioned these approved reimbursement rates. Is that in the record anywhere? Is that found in a regulation? Or?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It's in the record. It's at... it's in the exhibit stipulation, paragraph 11. It's the IHCP bulletin. It's at document number 25 in the record. And it lists the state's reimbursement rates for dental services.
So we would be able to look at that and get at least some ballpark idea.
That's right, Your Honor.
You know, what extractions versus dentures versus crowns versus mandibular implants.
Exactly, Your Honor. And as you pointed out earlier, for a full set of dentures, that's going to put you over $1,000 under the state's own reimbursement rates, and so you simply won't be able to get it. What I also want to make sure we don't skip over is that Indiana law has very clearly been interpreted by the state courts to say that medically necessary services must be covered and that any limitations must be consistent with medical necessity. This was the T line of cases, and they said it explicitly, and they looked specifically at the Indiana statutes and the Indiana regulations and said that those laws are unequivocal, that medically necessary services have to be covered. And in T, the state made the same argument that it makes today, that is that it can comply with the law by simply covering most people's medically necessary services.
Now, we're obviously not enforcing Indiana law here against anybody because there's a Pennhurst problem with that, but is it your argument that federal law is the same?
Yes, I do believe federal law is the same, Your Honor. I think that Indiana law is even more specific, and it has even...
Don't you have an Indiana law claim also?
We do. We have an Indiana...
But the judge's ruling was not based on the Indiana law part of your case, was it?
It was. It was based on both.
On both?
Yes. The district court below, yes. And, Your Honor, we brought this case originally in state court, okay? And this court has supplemental jurisdiction of the state law claim, but it was removed. The T court noted, it specifically noted and rejected the state's argument that it can just look at most people and whether they're covered for medically necessary services. And instead, that court held that the limitations and exclusions of Medicaid coverage apply only to treatments that are not medically necessary. That's a quote from the court. So as a matter of state law, this case can be quickly and easily determined. But
Help me with these cases that Mr. Steiner refers to out of the Fifth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit that essentially say you can put some limitations on. They can be numerical in some way, not date, number of days, number of visits, and so forth. And the cases that talk about you can have five prescriptions, those types of cases.
Right.
How do we get around those?
Well, first, Your Honor, I want to point out that no fewer than seven circuits have ruled the other way. And the only two circuits to have ruled that way were the Fourth and the Fifth, and those were in the early 1980s. And since then, the Fifth Circuit itself has ruled otherwise in Hope Medical Group. And although the Supreme Court hasn't directly addressed the issue, of course, in Beal versus Doe, it did say that serious statutory questions might be presented if a state Medicaid plan excluded necessary medical treatment from its coverage. So I would say that this court should follow the more recent majority view that medically necessary treatment has to be paid for. As to some of the lower court cases where they upheld limitations, each of those were very different from the situation we have here. For example, the Greer case, where they limited it to five prescriptions per month. In that case, the limitation there was what the court called a soft limit, meaning that anybody would have the opportunity to get an exception, to show that in their particular case it was medically necessary for them to have more than five prescriptions per month, and then they would get it. Of course, Indiana doesn't have that kind of limitation. And in the hospital cases where they were limited to a certain number of days, and hospital stay, of course, federal law does not allow the hospitals to kick people out if they're not stabilized. So many people with medically necessary services would still be covered under that situation. In this situation, $1,000 cap, nothing. No exceptions, no emergencies, $1,000 and you're off. Regarding the utilization control procedure, I just want to point out that this, first of all, this is not a procedure. Utilization control procedure by its own terms is a procedure. And here this is just a $1,000 cap. There's no procedure to it. And second, utilization control procedures are things like prior authorization controls that are created.
Well, it does come into play if the one price for a particular procedure is less than $1,000 and the other is over $1,000, right?
I'm not sure.
So the utilization control procedure, if one procedure is less expensive, the one is more expensive over it, it exceeds the cap.
Right. Yes, I do understand what you're saying. But again, Your Honor, that's not what we have here.
Well, I understand. But I'm just speaking in general terms.
Okay. But there's no nobody looks at what the request is and says, oh, well, you could get this for a cheaper procedure. There's no looking at it at all. Once it's a $1,000 cap, once you've hit that limit, that's it. There's no determination beyond that. And the state's own regulations acknowledge that utilization control procedures don't apply to services that are medically necessary. Specifically, they use that language in 405 IAC 5-1-1A3. It says that the state's rules relating to fraud, abuse, and utilization of services apply to services that are not medically reasonable and necessary. And, of course, the $1,000 cap does apply to medically necessary services. So even under the state's own regulations, this is not a valid utilization control procedure.
So could the state tighten up somehow on its definition of what is a medically necessary procedure?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It is up to the state to define medical necessity. The T Court made that clear, too.
So the state could say dentures are never medically necessary, you should just have extractions?
I don't think so, Your Honor. What the determination of medical necessity does actually have to be based, I think, on a medical determination.
Who decides that? Is there some department in Indiana that decides that?
I believe so. I believe it's just the Medicaid department itself, and I don't know who specifically within there, but they make the determination of medical necessity. Mm-hmm.
So they might rule out cosmetic dental work or...
Which other. I think they do.
Yeah.
The Indiana courts have been very clear that this kind of a limitation is not permitted because it applies to medically necessary services. And the federal courts have been equally clear. And the courts have looked at the language of the Medicaid law itself and quoted out it as saying all qualified individuals. And those holdings are in conformity with the language of the Medicaid Act. The district court decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time? You have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Actually, the first point I'd like to make is, and I don't think the Wilder case necessarily completely handcuffs this court. Wilder was very much directed to that Boren Amendment, which has been repealed. It doesn't really relate directly to the provision we have in question here. So I think you can look at the private right of action issue, and we would like you to do that because we do think that there's a great deal of ambiguity and the right is not clearly defined in this particular case, even if the word individual is used in some situations. We know from the Supreme Court's decision in Alexander that we've cited and other decisions that the court has indicated that not every one's care, individualized care, necessarily has to be dealt with in a state Medicaid plan. And the Beal case that the plaintiffs had cited did not state that we would be looking at requiring that the individual receive everything that they need.
Your opponent agreed that the state is entitled to define what procedures it's going to regard as medically necessary. Why isn't that the way this ought to be attacked?
Well, the medically necessary is really more of a trigger to decide whether there's going to be Medicaid payment.
Well, that's what I mean. So you could define things in the dental arena with a strict definition of medical necessity that would exclude procedures that seem more like frills.
Well, the whole Medicaid law is really set up to allow some flexibility by the states. So it could be done one way or another. It just so happens Indiana has done it this way. The utilization control, the way it's dealing with amount and scope is through the cap.
So it's excluding a lot of medically necessary services is what it's doing.
Well, one thing I'd like to clear up is certainly not clearing preventing any emergency services that need to be done because emergency services are covered under a different section, different way. So if you're in the hospital and you need emergency dental care, you can be covered under Indiana's law. We're talking about these are services that are just routinely performed in a dentist's office that are not covered, that have the cap, the $1,000 cap.
So like a crown, which would be way more than $1,000.
Well, it could probably, yes, something like a crown is usually not critical and not something that's usually emergency. Yes, so it would be something.
It's not
like
an emergency.
That.
No, it would be.
Plus it's a root canal.
Unless it's a root canal, which it could be.
There are a variety of things that are still covered that are done in a hospital emergency room that need to be done. But this kind of thing is not. In this case, there isn't actually even a set amount. The particular procedure that Ms. Bontrager wants is, there's no set amount that's even been determined. That's one of the problems with this. When they talk about it being $7,000, there's never actually been a bill submitted to the state, even for Ms. Bontrager, because the state, in this particular case, has offered to give her the service at this point, given the injunction. And we've not had the services, I understand, and a bill submitted, so we haven't even been able to determine what the appropriate amount would be for that. I'd point out that there are cases out there, like the Collin case from Arizona that we've cited, that do talk about the state being able to limit what it does in the area of dental care, and said that as long as the state provided for the emergency that come along, that would be sufficient under Medicaid law. And we do think you need to focus on the fact that a very high percentage of people are being covered, according to the record in this case. It was 99 plus. Even if it's not exactly 99 plus, it's a high percentage, perhaps 97, 98, 99%. It's a lot of people being covered. We would ask that the decision be reversed. Thank you.